one of the first people, if not the first person, to sign the book of condolence at the South African embassy in Trafalgar Square was David Cameron. But it's interesting to see that he had a freebie trip to apartheid South Africa right at the height of the ban, really. I mean, he admitted his party had got it wrong, though, over sanctions when he later visited Mandela. David Cameron accepted an all-expenses-paid trip to apartheid South Africa while Nelson Mandela was still in prison. An updated biography of the Tory leader reveals today a trip by Mr. Cameron in 1989, when he was a rising star of the Conservative Research Department, was a chance for him to see for himself, and was funded by a firm that lobbied against the imposition of sanctions on the apartheid regime. Critics described it as a sanction-busting jolly that raised questions about the character of the man who, after a week when the government's credibility on the economy hit a new low — this is back in April 2009, was on course to be Prime Minister in little more than a year's time.
Yeah, that trip in 1989 is quite interesting, because two other people were on that trip. One was Sir Kenneth Warren, who most people won't have heard of, but he's a rather important fundraiser for the Conservative Party and has been for many years, a money man. And the other third person on that trip was Dr. David Kelly. And the purpose of the trip was to go to Arms
this
Corps.
This is the government scientist who died in 2003.
The very same one. So there were three people on this delegation: Dr. David Kelly, Sir Kenneth Warren, and David Cameron, who is a 20-something from Conservative Central Office. And information we've been receiving suggests that there was a deal being cooked up. South Africa had 9 nuclear weapons. They originally had 10 nuclear weapons, which they developed at Pelindaba with the Israelis. One of them was exploded over the South Atlantic. That left 9 nuclear weapons. It's like 10 green bottles, isn't it, this story? Anyway, as the changes were about to take place in South Africa, the Magnus Malan, who was the defence minister, Arms Corps, which was the their equivalent of BAE Systems, and they basically went to the West via an intermediary called John Bradenkamp, who was an ex-Rhodesian SAS operative, but was now actually a major arms dealer. People can look him up on the internet, and they will find him. He actually lives in Kilmersdown in Somerset now. But basically, they did a deal. They said, we don't want Nelson Mandela and the ANC to have these 9 nuclear warheads. So
this is actually the white South African government saying that, well, since the country's going over to black majority rule, we think that they shouldn't have access to these secret nuclear weapons we've got.
Yeah, because otherwise Nelson Mandela would have got his finger on the nuclear button as soon as he won the election. That wasn't acceptable to the white South African elite, and it wasn't acceptable to the Western powers either. So they did a deal whereby these 9 nuclear warheads, which were uranium-based nuclear warheads, were sold to the Western powers. 6 to the Americans and 3 to the British. But what happened, the American warheads were loaded at Durban and taken to the US and dismantled. The 3 British warheads, and this is what the delegation, we suspect this delegation was about, they weren't sold to the British government directly. A private company called Astra Holdings, which was actually a subsidiary of Astra Fireworks, if people remember them, they set up by a chap called Stephen Koch, who used to be an MI6 officer. They bought the 3 warheads, as it were, on the black market from Arms Corps, and then sold them on to the British government for £50 million. And Margaret Thatcher, one of the last things she did as she left office was sign a payment order for £50 million to Astra Holdings for these 3 warheads. But the warheads, of course, they had bought them from the South African government at much less than £50 million. And those who were involved in this scam got basically a profit from it, including the Conservative Party itself, which made £17.8 million to fund the 1992 general election.
Now, it's a pretty shocking accusation, Martin. Also,
well, I've made it before.
People can find it online. It's an article by Peter Eyre. It's probably the best one to find, E-Y-R-E, on his own blog or on the Palestine Telegraph website about this whole story. But what evidence have you got for it?
Well, I'm getting evidence from people who were involved. So they're talking to me. I can't say who, because they've signed the Official Secrets Act. But in any case, as you say, if people want to check this story for themselves, they can find it on Palestine Telegraph or Peter Ayres.
I mean, this £17 million donation, for example, is there any evidence for that?
Yes, there is. Doug Hoyle, the Labour MP, had been tipped off about this, and it's in Hansard. He made a question in the House of Commons. I can't remember what the year was. It was in the 1990s. Say, well, where did this £17.8 million come from? and there was a sort of bluff, we can't possibly tell you, you'll have to look into it. But anyway, I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, even in banker terms, £17.8 million is not peanuts, and in political terms, it's quite a large amount of money.
Well,
possibly could have made the difference between Major losing or winning the election, for example.
Well, certainly a fascinating twist to David Cameron's trip.
There's a further twist to the story, of course, which is that the warheads themselves then went missing. They lost them.
Well, how did they get the money for this £17 million
then? They went round Tory party donors and asked them to chip in to the pot, and then all of these people would then be paid back, and they were paid back. We've been given a list of people who actually made a lot of money out of this.
Even our Prime Minister David Cameron historically was responsible for £17.8 million going adrift, and this is recorded in Hansard in Parliament, and no one to this day has questioned how that came about.
Well, of course, you are questioning it now. I mean, here you are actually saying, in effect, that this is the greatest Ponzi scheme in history.
What about, I don't want to equate it to the riots, I don't want to harp on about it, but the Bullingdon Club, I mean, you know, that's a youthful gang, you could almost call it, engages in violent behaviour. Do you see any likeness in that to what occurred in the...
I think we all do stupid things when we're young, and we should learn the lesson.
Did you witness stuff as a member of that club that was in its... Did you witness people throwing things through windows, smashing up restaurants?
No, I didn't. No, as I say, you didn't. We all do stupid things when
written
we're,
about as a very
when we're young, and I think that's clear. But I think what we saw in terms of the riots was actually very well organised in many cases, looting and stealing and thieving. We have to react very, very clearly to that. I mean, I think you can see that's what's happening in the courts.
I mean, the reason I'm raising it is whether this is a problem that goes well beyond these housing estates, and whether you're saying...
Well, I think I've answered that question, which is, yes, it does. And, you know, as I said, there were the people that walked past the shops that helped themselves. There's a problem of the breakdown of responsibility in many areas of life.
But
you have to address all of them. I thought the Mayor of London made a good point, which is that, you know, people... I think the way he put it was people weren't stealing from a shop because Gerald Kaufman had got a flat screen television on his expenses. I mean, I think, you know, and I think I might say that when you listen to the BBC, there's a sort of danger
that all these things are equated.
This into a great mush.
No,
and
but
maybe
people,
that is an excuse for not acting. And some people almost say, well, until we deal with the problem of inequality in our society, there's nothing you can do with rioting. Well, that's what it can slip into.
And that's not where I was going. It's more that people do just get caught up in things. And I'm sure you would say that you've got caught up in things. And in a sense, one doesn't want to have a moral panic about that section of society necessarily.
The point I'm making is that you've got to do two things. You've got to mend the parts of our society that are broken, and that is about strengthening families, about putting discipline back in our schools, about mending our welfare system, about making sure the signals we send to people are right. And you've got to have then particular attention at those parts that are particularly broken. But wider from that is there's a sense of we need to have greater responsibility through our society. And I've been, I think, you know, very consistent about that over many, many years.
Many of those that helped fund David Cameron's victorious campaign work in the City of London, and many run hedge funds that take high-risk investment strategies. Hedge funds have been blamed for helping to undermine the banks and contributing to our country's financial crisis.
Let me ask you this. Does this city's politics let Bristol down? All the evidence is, when this has been done elsewhere, you get a low turnout in the referendum, you get a relatively low turnout in the first mayoral election, but unlike other local elections where the turnout stays low, mayoral elections, the turnout tends to go up.
Prime Minister Jibril has confirmed that Colonel Gaddafi is dead. I think today is a day to remember all of Colonel Gaddafi's victims, from those who died in connection with the Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, to Yvonne Fletcher in a London street, and obviously all the victims of IRA terrorism who died through their use of Libyan Semtex. We should also remember the many, many Libyans who died at the hands of this brutal dictator and his regime. People in Libya today have an even greater chance after this news of building themselves a strong and democratic future. I'm proud of the role that Britain has played in helping them to bring that about, and I pay tribute to the bravery of the Libyans who've helped to liberate their country. We will help them, we will work with them, and that is what I want to say today. Thank you. Can I say what an honour it is to be here in Tripoli
with you to see how the Libyan people are taking their country back and taking it forward to a new era. A few weeks ago, Gaddafi was still in control here in Tripoli, and I think what the world has seen is frankly an impressive transformation. Your roads are full again of traffic, your water is flowing, your hospitals are working. This is impressive. And I'm proud of the role that Britain played in helping you to do this, and I'm even more proud, having seen what I've seen today, of the impressive changes you are making. But this was your revolution, not our revolution. It was those brave people in Misrata, in Benghazi, in Brega, in Zlitan, in Tripoli, in the Nafusa Mountains, who were incredibly brave in removing the dreadful dictatorship of Gaddafi. And I pay tribute to those people throughout Libya today. It is your revolution, it is their bravery that has enabled this to happen. As Nicolas has said, we want to help you diplomatically, militarily, economically, and with your development. We are your friends, but this is your country, your leadership, your plan. We stand ready to help, but we want to know what it is you most want us to do. This does go beyond Libya. This is a moment when the Arab Spring could become an Arab summer, and we see democracy advance in other countries too. And I believe you have the opportunity to give an example to others about what taking back your country can mean. I don't think any regime that carries out acts as they have against their own citizens, and continue to do so, by the way, should survive. I think that regime should go. So the message to President Assad is it is time for transition, it is time for you to go. The message to President Putin, who I discussed this with at the G8 in Mexico, and the message to all those on the UN Security Council, it is time for the UN Security Council to pass clear and tough messages about sanctions, I believe under Chapter 7 of the UN, and to be unambiguous in this. Now, obviously, we are a UN Security Council with permanent members, and permanent members that have vetoes. We can't pass these things without everybody stepping up to the plate and taking the right action. But I would appeal to those who in the past have held out against tough action against Syria, that, you know, what more evidence do we need about a regime that has brutalized its own people? And as I say, the alternative to political transition at the top of Syria is revolution from the bottom in Syria. And I think it is in everybody's interest, the Syrian people, the region, the wider world, the fight against terrorism. It is in everybody's interest that that transition takes place, and that political transition takes place quickly. The sooner that happens, the sooner the people of Syria can be freed from the tyranny under which they're currently suffering. Well, no decision has yet been taken, but let's be clear what is at stake here. Almost 100 years ago, the whole world came together and said that the use of chemical weapons was morally indefensible and completely wrong. And what we've seen in Syria are appalling scenes of death and suffering because of the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime. And I don't believe we can let that stand. Now, of course, any action we take or others take would have to be legal, would have to be proportionate. It would have to be specifically to deter and degrade the future use of chemical weapons. Let me stress to people, this is not about getting involved in a Middle Eastern war or changing our stance in Syria or going further into that conflict. It's nothing to do with that. It's about chemical weapons. Their use is wrong, and the world shouldn't stand idly by. Well, the question we have to ask ourselves is, if there is no action following this big use of chemical weapons, is it going to be more likely in future that more and more regimes will use chemical weapons, that this regime will use them again and again on a larger scale, and we'll see more death and more suffering? It must be right to have some rules in our world and to try to enforce those rules. Now, of course, as Prime Minister, I take my responsibilities about safeguarding our armed services incredibly carefully, incredibly seriously. But the question we need to ask is whether acting or not acting will make the use of chemical weapons more prevalent. There is never 100%
certainty. There's never one piece or several pieces of intelligence that can give you absolute certainty. But what we know is this regime has huge stocks of chemical weapons. We know that they have used them on at least 10 occasions prior to this last wide-scale use. We know that they have both the motive and the opportunity, whereas the opposition does not have those things, and the opposition's chance of having used chemical weapons, in our view, is vanishingly small. We know all these things. The question now for us is, are we more likely to deter the future use of chemical weapons by acting or not acting? That's the consideration. But let me say again, I understand people's concerns about getting involved in wars in the Middle East, getting sucked into the situation in Syria. This is not about wars in the Middle East. This is not even about the Syrian conflict. It's about the use of chemical weapons and making sure as a world we deter their use and we deter the appalling scenes that we've all seen on our television screens.